Hi, I'm Georgia Oakley, and you're listening to The Letterbox Show. I am excited to talk about my four favorite films, A Woman Under the Influence, Safe, Three Colors Blue, and Morven Keller, as well as my film, Blue Jean.
Hello, and welcome to The Letterbox Show, our podcast about the movies people love with the people who love those movies. I'm Gemma Gracewood, and in the ever-rotating joy of the show, my co-host today, live from London, is Alec Kim.
Hello, a pleasure to be here, Gemma. This is my first time as a Four Favourites co-host, but I have been a guest before a very long time ago. I think this podcast is sort of going to cancel out that previous episode, as I will reveal later, one of my four favourites is changing because of this episode.
Big episode.
But this is not about me. This is about our guests today. We are here only people with, first of all, non-North American accents and whose names end in A. Those are the only people allowed in the room. So please welcome the writer and director of Blue Jean, Georgia Oakley.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, Georgia, such a pleasure. Now, Blue Jean, Ella, you need to know about Ella. She has this habit of dropping into my DMs occasionally and going, Gemma, this is a film. And it's just those four words, this is a film. And I know that I have to drop everything else and sit up and pay attention. And in the most recent case, it was for Blue Jean, which, what an extraordinary film. What an extraordinary debut.
It's a bit rude how good Blue Jean is.
Guys, I'm going to get bashful.
Oh no, speechless, speechless on a podcast. It's a terrible situation.
Don't flatter me too much or the whole thing will be mute.
All right, okay, let's start somewhere different. It's Pride Month, Georgia. How do you like to exercise your gay rights in June?
Oh, that's a good one. I just got to LA and I just heard that last weekend was West Hollywood Pride, which I'm really sad to have missed. I mean, I would say Pride, for me, changes year on year, depending on where I'm at in my life. And this year, my Pride month has been celebrated by designing and hand stitching a Pride flag with my family, which is extremely niche. but I'm getting married the day before London Pride, and then we're going to go to Pride with the hand stitched flag that we have designed and
this
made.
Is amazing.
And basically it started off as an idea, like a very simple, like I was like, we should make a banner. And then my girlfriend, who's like really, I don't know, just she doesn't do anything by halves. She was like, yeah, let's do this and like get all this old fabric and like design. Anyway, so then we embarked on this incredibly long winded thing. And we got Billy, my stepdaughter, to design parts of it. And so that's not about exercising my rights, but that's how I'm celebrating Pride Month.
That's amazing.
Exercising your rights to be fully handmade is something quite glorious.
I will be working for a lot of Pride Month, but I always get excited to be involved in whatever I can, where I can. Hopefully there'll be something while I'm in the States this week.
Where historically has been your favorite place to celebrate Pride Month?
Usually I've been in London. So I'm very familiar with celebrating in London, but I now no longer live in London. So I've been, and I guess Pride's been kind of, everything's felt different post-pandemic. So I feel like this is going to be my entry back into proper big style Pride. Yeah, but it will also be different because I'll be there with the child, which I've not previously done.
That's fun. A child and a flag.
Yeah.
It's just the best. It's the best. I don't know whether to dive straight into it, but obviously there's the turf wars are happening at the moment. We had some a quite extraordinary individual attempt to breach the shores of Aotearoa, New Zealand, to try and have some talks with some people about their opinions. And the families of New Zealand's trans community turned out for that. And it was just, God, it was incredible. It's one of the best rallies I think I've ever been involved in terms of that the mood and the buoyancy, the signs, like, can we just talk about protest signs? They're amazing. But also the safety of everyone involved. And I took my 7-year-old and I lost him at one point. I was like, oh God, I do not want to lose this kid and amongst all these people. And then I looked up and he was right in the middle of the pagoda where the person was attempting to talk with a sign held right up high. And this is the most cheerful child you've ever met. Ella knows. She sees him on the computer all the time. But he just had this face, like this serious, serious face. And he just stood there like a statue for a good 10 minutes with a sign. And I've never been prouder.
That's amazing. Another way I've celebrated in the past is with the BFI float that they do, which is pretty cool.
Oh, tell us more about that.
Well, people involved in working for the BFI or who have been supported by the BFI get invited sometimes to go on their float as part of the parade. So one year when I was on the BFI FLEM mentorship for LGBTQ filmmakers, we were invited to be on the float, which felt like stepping into a whole new world of pride. I have a feeling we had to get there really, really early, and it was so different from my usual experience of pride. But yeah, it was amazing, and to sort of combine work and pride in that way felt really special.
We probably need to, for listeners, put this into a bit of context, right, in terms of what your work is and what Blue Jean is. So shall we chat about Blue Jean for a couple of minutes? Because I get the feeling, I don't know about you, Ella, but each of the films we're about to talk about will have some connection to your debut feature. So, I mean, interestingly, we're talking about political action and rallies and stepping up and turning up for your community, and it's a sort of central theme to Blue Jean, in that we've got this character who is a school teacher who is not out, is not ready to be out, but whose partner is very much out and engaged politically in 80s Thatcherite Britain at a time that, much like today, is incredibly unsafe for the queer community. So,
yeah, I mean, it's also about how, you know, the experience of coming out is not just a one-time thing. I think in cinema, we often get handed this kind of cookie cutter version of what it means to come out. And it's almost as if characters step through a portal into a new life once they've done that. And my producer and I were talking a lot about that when we started developing it, the film, about how coming out is actually like a daily thing. And it never stops. And in that sense, your very identity is politicized as a queer person, because you might not have planned to have a discussion about that with, say, your taxi driver, who's just assumed that your partner is your sister or something like that. You might not have planned to kind of have a discussion that has pushed into certain space, but you have to. And so quite a lot, you know, to do with where the story stemmed from in terms of the things that we wanted to explore.
Something that I loved from when Georgia and I spoke a while back for Letterboxd for our journal interview, I loved what you said about like how so often the kind of like the queer experience and Jean's experience in particular is like not wanting to fly a flag and not,
yeah,
pride can be like, I don't have to speak for everyone in every way. She just wants to live her life.
And that often I would look around at friends of mine, and I would see in a relationship that there would be someone who was more, who did want to fly a flag. That was part of who they were. And for them, it was like a daily thing, and it was something that they would do with pride. But then for others, it was a little bit more complicated than that. And the conflict that creates in a relationship, I find really interesting, because, you know, people are different and no one thing is necessarily right or wrong. But I think we are often handed this idea that one thing is preferable over the other. And I wanted to look at that and how it affects. Obviously, it's quite heightened in this story for particular reasons, but it was something that I noticed in a lot of dynamics around me and felt was kind of one of the things that takes the story out of the 80s and into the present day, because those sorts of things are still very much an issue.
It's the human experience to be perceived by other people at all times, right? And I was thinking a lot about in what ways Krzysztof Kieślowski's Three Colors Blue crazy segue, but bear with me. might bear some relation to Blue Jean, or to indeed the experience of every day coming out in a different way. And for me, I identified really deeply with this beautiful 1993 film, as will anyone who's experienced grief, the loss of someone close to them. And it's almost like grieving is that as well. From one day to the next, you just don't know how you're going to wake up, and you don't know who you're going to meet, especially if you're Julie in this film trying to reinvent yourself after the unimaginable loss of your husband and daughter. And you know, who are you when you lose the people closest to you? Julie packs up the house, moves to Paris, wants to be somebody different, but every day she's facing conversations that bring it up again. And is she going to say, well, I am, in her case, grieving a widow, experiencing deepest loss? And do you choose to have that conversation, or do you choose to go, I'm not having that today. I'm not letting these people into who I am today.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. Yeah, I also just think that taking a character who is greatly affected by something emotionally and doesn't quite understand, you know, most of us aren't really aware of why we behave the way that we behave at any given moment. And maybe if we're lucky, a few years down the line, we might be able to unravel those things. But that was definitely one of the starting points for Blue Jean. And a similarity that I see with Three Colors Blue, where, a character's behavior is unpredictable because of her emotional headspace being unpredictable. And it can be surprising, but I like watching films about that sort of interrogate one person's life and choices, particularly if they don't really understand why they're doing what they're doing, and that we have to go on a kind of journey of unraveling that with them. And I think I see that in now looking at the bird's eye perspective of these films I've chosen. I feel like that's probably quite a running theme.
So this is the first of the Three Colors trilogy. It has a 4.1 out of 5 star average on Letterboxd. It's beloved. It is so beloved. I was looking up a bit about Kieslowski, who died at 55, which just seems impossibly young, you know. God, but he was in a hurry, wasn't he? He made so many incredible films with his writing partner, the other Christoph. But I was looking at this in a 1995 speech at Oxford. He said, if culture is capable of anything, then it's finding that which unites us all. And there are so many things which unite people. It doesn't matter who you are or who I am. If your tooth aches or mine, it's still the same pain.
Oh, I do think also that for a kind of pain to be perceived as so universal on film, you have to have an absolutely knockout performer who is going to hold your attention who's basically in every scene, which, you know, in this film it's Juliette Binoche playing Julie, but in Blue Jean, Rosie McEwen, oh my God, she is unbelievable. As we say, they're different films, but just to have, there's so much kind of, I hate using the word strength when you talk about like female performances, but to just carry everything in, I don't know, every kind of wave of emotion in every way. There aren't many performers who can do it as brilliantly, I think, as, you know, the kind of performances that you see in Three Colors Blue. I mean, and in some of the other films we're going to talk about as well. Georgia, have you always been a Juliette Binoche stan?
Yeah. Always, big time. I think I'm always really drawn to films with an interesting central female lead that, and often those are films where that character is in every scene. And often those films, I'm talking about the kind, like Michelle Williams is another. I mean, actually, we talked a lot about some of these actors, Rosie and I, in the lead up to Blue Jean, because, and I remember her saying to me, oh, I've never sort of talked about other actors' performances so much in the sort of preparation for a role, but it was a way, I don't know, yeah, there was just something, I can't remember exactly which films we talked, I remember we looked at some Kelly Reichardt films as well, those are the performances, I mean, those are the films that I love, and so it makes sense that that's what I attempted to do with Blue Jean, to make a film that where there's this one character who's in every scene. And I knew when casting her that the film would kind of live or die by that performance. And so I think maybe because also my background was in theatre, I started off doing theatre, and at the budget level that the theatre that I was doing was, you didn't have any money for kind of fancy staging or anything. So the performances were everything. And I chose always plays that had small casts, so that I could have the actors in my living room every day. And there weren't kind of 15 chorus people that, you know, everyone was able to be in one room. There was maximum 4 characters kind of thing. And it was just performance, performance, performance. And I only really did that because I wanted to make films, and there was no real way to go about doing that at that age. And at the university I went to, there was no film society or anything. So I used theater as a kind of, because it was available to me. But ever since, I think it had a big effect on the way that I work, and also on the focus that I put on performance. And it's the only thing. I remember in the preparation for Blue Jean, you have kind of more time to do prep than you do to actually shoot the film. And most of that time I found pretty hellish. I mean, it was like incredibly intense, and all you're doing is worrying about all the things that could go wrong. But the final week of prep was rehearsals. And that was the first time where I felt like I could breathe, because it was just me and my actors just doing what I knew how to do. And I wasn't sort of stressed about it. I wasn't worried. It felt very natural. And so, yeah, I think performance is always, and yeah, again, looking at these 4 films, performance is key really in all of those films.
Oh, so, so deeply key. But also, God, I could listen to you talk about theatre all day long. Yeah. It's really, really interesting to think about the experience of watching Blue Jean now, knowing how much theatre experience you have. It is that focus, that deep, deep attention to detail on that performance and that central person. But having said that, when we're talking about Three Colours Blue specifically and that trilogy, gosh, there's something that cinema can do, isn't there, that no other medium can do. And specifically in this case, yeah, put grief on screen, but also it's the music. For me, I could watch a movie all day long of Juliette Binoche staring at notes in hyper focus and in absolute maximum zoomed in. Like, what lens were they using to get that beautiful handwritten score that she's reading? And it sounds so simple. It was almost like watching a YouTube lyric video, right? When the camera is moving across the notes at the same time as you're hearing those notes.
Yeah, no, it actually reminds me of, I listened to something the other day. It was talking about Kate Blanchett and Tar, and how the filmmaker had understood that what we want from Kate Blanchett is to watch her do things, and to watch her do things incredibly well. I can't remember who said that, but it was basically like, yeah, we've understood that, you know, if we can watch her speaking fluent German or conducting an orchestra, then that's really all we need is like, we can just watch that.
We just want to watch Kate Blanchett being a bad person incredibly well for 2 and a half hours.
And it doesn't matter what she does. It's like, Kate Blanchett is in the same category of performers as Juliette Binoche. It does not matter what they do. As long as they do things consistently the whole runtime, she can, I don't know, she can sell her flat. She can burn all of her husband's things. She can watch paint dry. It doesn't matter. She's doing it. And I'm watching it. That's it. That's all.
Just in terms of the way that this film, Three Colours of Blue, has landed with the Letterboxd community, there's a couple of great lists that it's on. Hunkat. I love Hunkat's lists, but this particular one, movies that you initially thought were okay, but hit you so damn hard when they ended, which is so this, right? And then a lovely list by C, What Will I Do With This Life? One of the things I love about this community is how a film lover can encapsulate, you know, an entire kind of branch of cinema through a beautifully titled list that they organize some films into. I think one of the things I love about Three Colours Blue, about Blue Jean, about about, I guess, grown-up, mature cinema is this understanding that you don't have to have an antagonist and a protagonist. There doesn't have to be, you know, cinematic conflict as we know it. The conflict can be, and in this case is specifically, I want to be free of this grief and this pain and this person I was. And the journey is, I can't be free of that because that is me and I am her. God, that final shot.
The final shot, I simply, I hadn't seen this film in a very long time. I don't think I had seen it. I hadn't rewatched it since Portrait of a Lady on Fire first came out. Mm. And like rewatching this now, I just think, I don't know, I feel like Three Colors Blue has to have set the bar for any time that anyone wants to make you feel something with classical music and feel it in a very like, what am I going to do with my life now kind of way. Like, now that I've seen this film, what will I do with my life? I think there's a difference between having a satisfying needle drop in the middle of a film and then having a final scene, which is just hot. Listen to this first and then let the rest just kind of come over you.
It's masterful. Ending films. Who was I listening to? Someone on the plane. I was listening to Noah Baumbach talk about how you only have one chance to introduce your audience to your protagonist. And he was talking about openings. And I feel like the same can obviously be said for endings. And I think people often get the introduction right, but endings are very, very hard to pull off. One of my other favorite films, if I'd had more on the list, Claire Denis film with the dancing sequence at the end. What's it called?
Beau Travail.
Yeah. One of my other favorite films is Beau Travail and also has one of the best final sequences of any film. But yeah, ending a film with that much power and allowing the rest of the film to wash over you, as you said, is the work of a great master.
Ella, just because you mentioned needle drops, I need to know from you, Georgia. In Blue Jean, you were spoiled for 80s choice. What song did you most want?
Ooh, that's an interesting one. Well, most of the tracks that are in the film were in the script. I had a Spotify playlist back in 2018 when I started writing the film, and I was listening to it constantly. In fact, I'll never be able to listen to it again. Probably about time I listened to it. But I had a lot of those tracks were in the script. The only one that wasn't was New Order, because I wouldn't have been that stupid to have assumed that we could have got New Order. But also, I was thinking, I didn't. It's sort of representative of how we weren't, as filmmakers with this film, we weren't wedded to realism. And the music that I've chosen is not what you would have found in your local club in Newcastle that year, for instance. That wasn't the approach that I had for music. It was much more on a feeling and kind of allowing myself to have the creative license to work with tracks that I love and that mean something to me and therefore meant something when I was writing the film. One of the tracks that I really wasn't ready to let go of was Let the Music Use You by the Knight Riders, which is the track when Jean is in the club and there's a drag queen performing, and she's realizing kind of the extent of what she's done, I guess. And that track was in the script and was in this original Spotify playlist and then was in all of our rough cuts, but we could not. It's very famous, I think sort of Detroit house, you know, very, very famous track from then. And one of the owners of the rights was just not available. And so I kept being told, we're not going to be able to have that track. And I just couldn't let it go. There are others. I mean, I probably would have said the same for each of them. I was quite belligerent about the whole thing. But in the end, our producer's wife, who is a brilliant recordist at the BBC, she was like, well, maybe we can re-record this track. Because we had the rights to use the track in the film, but we did not have the rights to that version. that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But obviously that threw up a whole load of really complicated things, because the types of synths and whatever else, I don't know how to speak about music very articulately, but the types of machinery that they used to make that track in the 80s were quite old school and low key and like don't exist anymore, don't, you know. So to create the exact sounds that are in that track was incredibly difficult. And so all credit goes to the team of people, including Ellen's wife, who re-recorded that for us, because it sounds exactly the same as the track itself.
Speaking of great synth tracks on films, we should move on and ask, is anyone else here allergic to the 20th century? It's time to talk about Safe, isn't it? It's time to dive into Todd Haynes' 1995 film, another great leading performance from an actress, Julianne Moore's first lead role, which is quite amazing to think about. This came out in 1995, and the logs for this film on Letterboxd in March, April 2020 went through the roof for quite obvious reasons. Safe is about Carol, played by Julianne Moore, an upper middle class LA housewife, 1980s, begins to complain of vague symptoms of illness, has a nosebleed, walks out of aerobics class. She just doesn't feel right. Her male family doctor treats her concerns dismissively. He suggests a male psychiatrist. I say this with, you know, intention. Is it the environment? Is it the 80s perm that she impulsively decides to get one day? Is it the patriarchy? Only time at a wellness retreat run by a man. We'll tell. Let's talk about why Safe is in your four favourites, Georgia.
Oh, God, it's just so good. I think there's just some films where you get to the end and you know, I didn't see it when it first came out, but it has something of it has something that makes it immediately feel like a cult classic. It's unforgettable. The performance is brilliant. Same thing, you know, central female lead. I think it's just the detail and the fact that I love films that are set in a kind of, that feel like horror, I guess, when they're not. And that scene, there's just a few scenes that always stick in my head. Like there's a scene where she's having sex with her husband at the beginning, and it just feels so like there's just something about the way that is shot, the color palette. We actually used used that film a lot as a reference for Blue Jean color palettes and that kind of thing. And I love how the sort of soft pastel colors are used to represent the most hostile of environments. It's the kind of film where you're just, every time you watch it, you're going to discover new details. And I just don't think that can be said for many films. When people ask me what my favorite films are, I often think about, I'm always being asked by friends, you know, tell me a good film. You make films. Tell me a good film. What film should I?
I love that question. I need to ask, are you on Letterboxd? Because I find that quite handy for making lists of films that my friends should see.
I use Letterboxd for looking at what people have written about films all the time, but I don't have it for logging my own watching history. I should do.
You could make a list of fail-safe options that has maybe 20, 30 titles on it, that every time a friend says, you're a filmmaker, recommend a film, that can be the name of the list.
I should.
And then I just send that.
Yeah, that's the thing, because when people ask, this is what I was saying about Safe, is like when people ask, it's sort of, there's so many things you have to consider, and there's such a huge contingent of people that kind of, I don't know, don't like a film if it's too depressing or whatever it is. Mm. And so I have all these voices in my head when I'm trying to write those lists for people. And when something is as unforgettable and kind of striking as Safe, and that has so much attention to detail and like interesting things that unravel each time you watch it, I think it's a fail. So, you know, even if they don't enjoy it, they will appreciate the experience of watching it, if that makes sense. And that's kind of where I often go with my lists. I'm not really thinking about people's enjoyment, but just like, will they be pleased that they've watched that film? And I think that Safe is one of them. I'm a big Todd Haynes fan anyway. The way it's shot is like, it's so mesmeric. Also the opening sequence, same thing, you know, just where you're introduced to that world, there's just something, the feeling, this sort of unnerving feeling that you get from that, that opening sequence that lingers throughout the whole film.
Opening sequence and closing sequence in that film, just getting both exactly right.
Yeah.
My
yeah.
God. I watched this on Criterion channel, and then I watched an interview that, that Todd and Julianne did with each other for the, I guess, the 20th something anniversary of the film. And it was so, God, they just talk so well together. Obviously, they've got this long relationship now, but this was their first work together. And it's silly, I hadn't noticed it, but they were talking a lot about the framing. Julianne's character, Carol, another of Todd's famous Carols, begins the film kind of sideset. Even in that scene you're talking about when her husband, she and her husband are in bed together, she's her head's to the side and she's sort of always offset in the frame throughout the film. And then she comes slowly, slowly, slowly towards the center. And at the end, she's, you know, front and center in that frame. They were talking, but Julianne was talking about how she, that experience of being the lead actress who's in almost every scene of that film kind of ruined her for other directors, because she'd go onto other sets and she'd be like, okay, great, that's my motivation in the scene, but where am I placed in the frame? And the director will be like, I don't know, I haven't figured it out yet. We'll just kind of put the camera on you and see how. No, I need to know. I need to know precisely where I will be in the frame. And that's what I can work with. And I just love that attention to detail.
Yeah, that's so important. Yeah, now you say that, you can imagine, yeah, you can just see it. I hadn't noticed that.
Georgia, you were going to lose it for May, December, Todd Haynes' new film with Julianne Moore in it.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen Safe before. I saw May, December in Cannes last month, and I hadn't seen Safe before. So coming to Safe, like coming to Julianne Moore's first role, after seeing her most recent one, it's astonishing how, I mean, we know this, but like how good, like consistently good she is. It's like you could put those two performances side by side and you wouldn't be like, you know, work on yourself for 20 years. That's like, you'd never say that. I need to stress again, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying the opposite. But May, December is, it's, I think it's amazing. It's like, it's not horror at all. And there are lots of really funny bits. It's, I think it's funnier than Safe. The only comedy I see in Safe is like the tiny bit of hindsight with everyone logging it in May, March 2020. Yeah. It's not a funny, like it's not a funny film. Yeah. But yes, but I think May, December like leans into the kind of melodrama, low-key domestic horror, and Julianne Moore just doing everything. Like she's doing so many performances within her performance, which I feel like is kind of happening in Safe as well. It's like there are so many layers of what she's experiencing and what she wants to believe at any given moment. It's very unnerving.
Yeah. That's, I mean, yeah. When people talk to me, I sometimes think that it's really interesting that as a director, you get asked a lot about actors and acting, but I think a lot about how there's this hugely unknowable quality about acting. You know, it's like people can ask me as much as they want about Rosie, and I can tell you how she had the energy I was looking for to for the character of Jean in my film, et cetera, and how brilliant she was and how her work ethic was amazing and all the rest of it. But I can't really tell you how she's doing what she's doing. I don't know, you know, and it's those performers where there's so much going on under the surface. And in the case of Blue Jean, we were shooting out of sequence, very much out of sequence. And Rosie was in every scene. And so she would have to jump around the script from very different points, you know, and getting herself into the right headspace for those scenes without any break, because we had an incredibly difficult schedule. It's just, yeah, I can't really, to me, actors are really kind of unicorns in the way that what they do is totally mystical, and when done right, you shouldn't notice. This is the thing, you don't notice any of the work they're doing. You shouldn't notice. You should just be taken with their performance, and that can be said for Julianne Moore every time. I mean, she's just we had a funny experience actually at the BAFTAs where they asked us if we would have a photo taken, and there was a whole wall of photographers and they were just about to like line up their shot or whatever. And then suddenly all the cameras just went over there to the left of us. And we could tell that no one wanted to take a picture. And they were all going, Julianne, Julianne. And we turned and there was Julianne Moore looking like, you know, this crazy, amazing movie star that she is. And we just very quietly walked off the carpet.
Oh no.
I was thrilled because, you know, I mean, she's amazing.
I mean, she is amazing. She in that same interview with Todd, she goes into, and this is the unicorn nature of it, right? I've just watched the movie for the first time, I might add. And I have to say, there's a funny thing during the pandemic, you were either, I think, a safe person or a contagion person. And I was very much a Steven Soderbergh's contagion. I needed to...
Same.
Yeah, I needed to see the practical, you know, way that this pandemic was going to unfold. And I would keep checking back in and go, where on the contagion timeline are we right now? Like, all the trucks are rolling down the highways with the vaccines. This is exciting. Safe, I would have been a mess, a total mess. Feminist horror fiction is not what I needed during that first lockdown. But having just watched it, you know, this week, and then immediately seeing Julianne talk about the very technical decision she made about the voice of the character very early on. And she was like, okay, so this is a character who essentially doesn't exist. You know, she's a housewife, she's a stepmother, she's not even a real mother, you know. She exists to service the husband and the child and the house, but she has sort of no other function in society, or so she thinks. And so I need to make her voice disappear. And she does it in the interview. She demonstrates how she just doesn't touch the larynx. She doesn't land on the larynx. And you're just like, oh, and she figured that out before the audition.
Wow.
She figured that out before she even sat down with Todd. And you're just wild. Oh, that is a superpower.
Yeah.
But speaking of actresses and transformations, I need to read you this Letterboxd review by, I don't know if you know the actress Hari Neff. She writes, don't at me, but Todd Haynes made a film about a straight, white, cisgender woman that illustrates queer experience more incisively and viscerally than the vast majority of contemporary films showcasing queer-identified characters. And that's the power of cinema, baby.
Yeah, wow, that's exactly right. Yeah. And it's interesting how quite a few films do that sort of under the radar or have this sort of, seem to be exploring the queer experience so clearly, but then actually the biggest example of that is often kids films, which I'm now watching quite a lot of, where you're like, the character is queer, but the character's not queer, but like everything about their journey is kind of...
Which kids film? I need to know.
All of them.
What's your kid watching?
For a long time I had to watch Frozen, and I remember thinking, you know...
Oh yeah.
Actually no, better example than Frozen, although it's kind of the same story, is Moana, where she's like, you know, everybody on this island is so happy, everybody, and she, you know, she's just like drawn to the water, and all she, you know, she feels different and she doesn't know why, and she, it's like, yeah, every single line of
girl, you're
the
gay
lyrics.
Maybe the live action, I don't know, maybe the live action version will do it.
Yeah,
I do want to say, in terms of reading Letterboxd reviews of films, here is one about Blue Jean from Izzy. Directly after this film, I went out to a lesbian bar and felt I'd unlocked another meaning, a direct line between the women in this film and those who inspired their creation and my own life. What's a film that did for you what Blue Jean is doing for Izzy and so many other Letterboxd members?
Oh, wow. Maybe Tomboy, Celine Siama's film. I just remember it having such a profound effect on me when it first came out, and not really, I mean, it was around that time. When did that come out? 2011 or something? It was probably around that time that I had joined a DVD shop, like a physical shop that didn't really exist anymore. And I would go on my way back from work every day. I would rent a new film and drop it back on my way into work the next day. And I watched Tomboy as soon as it came out. And I just, I had spent so much of my childhood just kind of shape-shifting to fit into whatever environment I found myself in. And then I watched that film and it's just, yeah, it sort of retrospectively spoke to the child version of myself in a way that felt really profound. But yeah, loads of film. I mean, that's why I love films, is that they have the power to do that. And I have memories of watching films that, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but sometimes I would watch a film on my own in London and come out of the screen and feel and need to go home. You know, it'd be like 11 o'clock at night. I need to go home, go to work the next day. But I would walk, instead of walking to the nearest tube station, I would walk past that tube station to the next one or the next one and get on, you know, to allow myself an hour or so to just walk and kind of process the feeling that I was left with after watching that film for whatever reason, if it hit me really hard. And I think that, you know, I love all sorts of art forms. I love going to exhibitions and stuff, but I just, that to me, that feeling is very, very specific to the cinematic experience and being locked in a dark room with other individuals that you don't know, most of whom you don't know. And then kind of the feeling of leaving the cinema and having that, being left with that energy. I think it's just so specific. And I can't think of anything else that makes me feel like that.
That brings me on to another one of your four faves, because the feeling you just described is the exact experience of my first watch of A Woman Under the Influence, John Cassavetes' film from 1974. Everybody knows how incredible this film is. It has a 4.3 out of 5 average rating on Letterboxd. It is one of your four favourites that you have chosen. I have to say that after the recent rewatch that I did for this podcast, it's now one of mine.
Wait, what? Replacing? Okay, this is... Ella doesn't change up her four faves.
I never change them.
Oh, wow.
No, I never change them. I never change them.
The influence of Georgia Oakley. This is
so thank
huge.
You.
This is huge.
It's huge. But honestly, when I saw that you had chosen this film, I was so excited because I actually haven't logged the film since I got Letterboxd in 2017. I know. Because the first watch before that was when I was at university. I was studying film. And our lecturer would always put on certain films maybe twice a week. And most of the time, because we were all bad students, we would kind of ignore them a bit. And he put on Woman Under the Influence and left and went to his office or something. And maybe... Dude. This is what he did. Yeah. He just left. And maybe 40 minutes into it, there was a technical glitch. I think like the sound went off or something. And I think there's maybe 15 of us in this seminar group. Everyone at once was just like, what's happened? We have to fix it. Where did it go? This has never happened. I ran to my tutor's office and he was just like, what's happened? Like, is someone unwell? And I was like, yes, all of us. It's like, the film's not working. So it wasn't quite a cinema, but yeah, that kind of shared experience of just like, I need to walk around for ages and process this. This has kind of changed everything a little bit. A Woman Under the Influence is it. But sorry, the synopsis before we continue, because we need to hear why it is it for you. A Woman Under the Influence is about Mabel Longhetti. She is the titular woman played by Gina Rowlands. She is a powerhouse of a wife and a mother, and her municipal construction worker husband, Nick, played by the incredible Peter Falk. He adores her, but Mabel's volatility leads Nick to have her committed for the safety of their children. But then Mabel returns home.
And what time are we having spaghetti?
This is what I want to know. Georgia, do you know what time it is when they have spaghetti? Because, yeah, rewatching it, like I rewatched it with my boyfriend and he was convinced it was the morning. And I thought it was like late afternoon, evening.
Yeah, it feels morning-ish, yeah. Like they've done a night shift or something. I don't know. I would love to go to a dinner party with Mabel. I feel like Mabel and Carol from Safe need to meet each other, and like Mabel needs to bust Carol out of that wellness retreat run by Frank from Succession.
They could.
And they need to go to a place where women's hysteria is celebrated. Mm. And and the feminine grotesque, as famous Letterboxd list by the brilliant vulture writer Angelica Jade Bastien, the feminine grotesque, this sits squealy. It's like the film, right? It's like these women. When was the first time that you saw a woman under the influence? Was it big screen, small screen? Were you alone? Were you with a Mabel?
Sadly, it was small screen. It was small screen, but I would say because I remember sort of stumbling upon it, which sounds kind of implausible considering how famous it is, but I remember stumbling upon it and having exactly that feeling. And I would go as far as to say this is the best performance for me. This is the best performance in any film ever, and that is one of the main reasons it's on my list. But I think there's so few films where 10 minutes into the film, you are feeling the kinds of emotions that you might feel maybe if you're lucky, 90 minutes into most films. But it has you on the edge of your seat in a way that, you know, I don't like films that try to keep you on the edge of your seat, if you know what I mean. My taste in film is quite specific, and I don't deviate all too much from my taste. In fact, yesterday I was on a plane for 11 and a half hours, and I take great joy in looking around me at what people are watching, and I'm boringly predictable with my choices. But anyway,
what did you watch?
I watched oh, it was a really good run for an airplane. I watched EO, it was amazing. I got to watch that having never seen it before. Yes, I know I would prefer to have seen it in the cinema, but it's been a busy year and I didn't manage to. And I also saw another film that I was dying to see that hadn't seen in the cinema, which was 1976, the Chilean first feature, which was just mind-blowingly good. And like, I couldn't believe it was a first feature. That was actually played with Blue Jean at London Film Festival in the first feature category. Brilliant film. Definitely watch it. And then the third one I watched was Blue Bayou.
Yes.
Which had me sobbing. But yeah, films that keep you on the edge of your seat. I'm not really into those, but this film absolutely does that. And again, there are just so many standout scenes. Namely the scene where she's in the bar kind of close to the beginning where she takes that guy home. It's just the performances are just out of this world. And the effortlessness. I know people always say you know a good film when you're not really thinking about how they achieved something. You're just in it and you're kind of just enjoying the story. But I actually don't know that I fully agree with that, because I do also love to watch a film that has me taken with the storyline and the brilliant performances and everything else, but also where as it's unraveling, I feel myself wondering how on earth the shots were achieved or the performances or the way that the performances intersect with the way that the camera is moving or whatever it is. It's something that I know as a filmmaker is extremely complex and that I leaves me guessing as I'm watching it. I actually really enjoy that feeling because I feel, I don't know, yeah, just to watch a master at work in any capacity is rewarding. And this is a complete masterclass, this film.
There's a Letterboxd review that I really enjoyed, which I think speaks to exactly your point. Felipe writes, Is there a movie with better camera work than A Woman Under the Influence? The entire film is about finding the precise distance between the image and Roland's and Falk's bodies. They are both amazing, of course, but it goes down to how one can locate all the messiness of their love dance in all its tenderness and ugliness.
Mm.
Which I thought, it's just the way,
like
the camera has to catch everything they're doing. It's like if you don't have the right tools to kind of be that, because it's all so precise and so minute, even though they seem like big performances in a way, if you can't catch, you know, all of the detail that's falling down, then it's lost.
The combination of these big performances, as you say, with the naturalism of, you know, the relationship between Gina Rowlands and the kids and those scenes that just feel like you've kind of stumbled into somebody's home and you're watching through a window. They're so naturalistic and brilliant. But the combination for me, that's what makes it such a winner, of those moments with these kind of bigger moments that feel like kind of classic old school big movie acting. That's what makes it. And also it feels so ahead of its time and like it will never stop being relevant.
Yeah, it never will stop being relevant. I was thinking about A Woman Under the Influence while I was watching Safe, and watching the character Carol and Safe going to all of these different health specialists who are men, who are, you know, and she's sitting there with her husband and they're telling the husband, and they're giving the husband the contact information for the psychiatrist. And, you know, so we've got 70s, that's 80s. Even now, we're still only coming to terms with, you know, in terms of long COVID, how it's different for women from what it is for men. And it just goes on and on. But the other thing that links all four of your favourites and Blue Dream are these extraordinary central performances by actresses. And so we need to talk a bit about Samantha Morton in Lynn Ramsey's Morven Keller, because, wow, it's just, as an actress reading that script, I imagine it's like, okay, so I'm playing this extremely potentially unlikable person who does quite a wild thing at the beginning of the film, which is when her boyfriend kills himself at Christmas. She takes his unpublished manuscript, puts her name on it, sends it to a publisher, and then takes the money and runs to a British seaside holiday with a girlfriend. And it goes from there, and it's like, wow, do we like her? Do we like this Morven Keller? Does that matter? What is going on here? One of the best Christmas films ever.
Yeah. I just think Lynn Ramsey is completely unrivaled in what she does. I don't even remember showing her work. I never really come to her as like a reference point, because I feel, to me, she's sort of like up on this pedestal, like untouchable. You know, I find her work so inspiring. And during the development of Blue Jean, we were on a program called iFeatures, and we all had to bring in a scene from a film that we found, you know, was the kind of thing that made us want to get up in the morning. And I remember showing a scene from Lynn Ramsey's short film, Gas Man. And I feel like the two works kind of speak to each other and are quite similar in terms of the style. I love that it doesn't matter. Well, I feel like it doesn't matter whether I never even thought about whether or not I like her as a result of what she's done in the film. You know, it's sort of not part of the discussion, or at least it didn't feel like it was for me. This is probably my favorite British film of all time. There are so many scenes in it that just feel so, just everyone's been to, I don't know, there's something like, okay, it captures that moment in time in your life so brilliantly, but with this kind of unexpected backdrop. But it's not the setup of the film that makes it so special for me. I think it's just, it's the energy. And the way, you know, there's a scene where they're kind of walking through a party. They're walking through a party inside, and everybody, all these different things are happening and unraveling. Again, it's one of those moments as a filmmaker where you're just like, how did that happen? Was it choreographed? Was it not? So many details to pick up on and to wonder.
Anyone who has a party scene in a script they are working on who is listening needs to watch that party scene. It is two things. It's one of the best depictions of parties in the 90s as I knew them on screen. I don't know how she did that. Like, I can smell it. Mm-hmm. and two, it's one of the best party scenes in which you're so aware of the central character and her place in that time. Oh, it's so good. So good.
I do love, in terms of the Britishness of it as well, that until this year, with another brilliant British debut, Molly Manning-Walker's How to Have Sex. Until that film, I do think that Morven Keller was one of the only films that you could point at and be like, oh, this is the kind of rite of passage girls holiday that you go on. But it's so funny that the sort of circumstances, I'm like, well, it's not that. But it's not that as well. Yeah. You know, it's like they do end up in the same kind of place that, you know, the girls who've just finished their GCSEs are going to go and have a big blowout. Mm. But it's so funny, just the kind of, and it's not a funny film, but it is so funny how you get to where Morven is. She's just like, we're going to have, excuse my language, we're going to have a fucking great holiday. Like that's the energy. Yeah. That's just it.
I think also there are so many British films that have something of that energy or try to address that sort of a moment in somebody's life, but through a male protagonist perspective. And this is probably, when it came out for me anyway, it was such a standout because there just aren't, you know, there just aren't so many. As you say, there aren't many. Everyone can relate to it, and yet where's the evidence? So yeah,
Blue Jean. I know that we you know, we're sort of coming to the end of the of our time with you, and so I did want to ask, when we're talking about party scenes, well, the bar scene in Blue Jean, you shot in 16mm, which now I'm getting a sense of busy schedule, shooting out of order. Oh my God, shooting on 16mm. Okay, first of all, amazing film with all of that in mind. And then you've got this pivotal, beautiful lesbian bar scene, which has been so written about in Letterboxd reviews, like this, the safest space of all, where one of the most dangerous potential things is happening for Jean. And, you know, when the student comes into the bar, spoilers, sorry. Can you talk about constructing that scene, because there's a lot going on?
Yeah, I mean, that I guess in the sort of classical sense, that was always a sort of turning point in the film, and was quite pivotal in terms of plot, and as I think I said before, it was something that one of our key inspirations for the film, Catherine Lee, Catherine Lee, who was one of our one of the women whose lives inspired Blue Jean, she had told us about running. She had told us, but also had written her own diary entries at the time, and then shared those diary entries with us. So we had this kind of very accurate first-hand account of what it felt like to walk into a bar with friends and to be approached by a student. And this happened to Catherine, and it's not exactly, it wasn't exactly the same as how it plays out in the film, but more or less, you know, she doesn't behave how she wished she could have behaved as a result of all of these different things, all of these different pressures that she found herself under. And it was speaking to Catherine 5 years ago and hearing the emotion in her voice when she told us the story about how she had behaved and how she had dealt with the situation of running into a student in a bar, and that student essentially coming out to her in the school, and how she squashed that essentially and did not engage with it and did various things that she felt extremely emotional about 30 years later. And that was one of the huge kind of, I think if it hadn't been for that conversation, there may not be a film, because it was one of the things that just kind of, where every time we were knocked down trying to get funding or whatever it was, I would always come back to that conversation as a sort of motivation. And I also found it really fascinating, you know, what is it, what kinds of things can co-conspire to make somebody behave in a way that they regret so deeply so many years later? So yeah, it was really pivotal in terms of that moment landing on screen. In terms of constructing it, it was quite complicated because I wanted to get a sense of there being this, it being a Saturday night and there being this kind of energy in the space and all of these women. One of the things that some of the women we spoke to liked to do was reading the ads in the queer magazine that would be brought up from London and kind of laughing about the things that people wrote. And so segueing from that moment where the group of women are sat around a table laughing to Jean being at the bar and spotting Lois for the first time was quite complicated, not just in terms of setting up the shots, but in terms of kind of transitioning the mood, both in the edit and when we were shooting it. But I wanted to create a sense that all of the air kind of leaves the room at that moment for Jean. How sad it was. I guess one of the things that really struck me was that we would speak to these teachers who were saying that, you know, it wasn't just students. They might see another teacher in a bar, another teacher from their school in their local lesbian bar. And that should have been at a time that was so difficult for them personally. That should have been a comforting thing. They should have been able to, even if they couldn't speak about it at school, it should have been comforting to be able to go to work and know that you had an ally there, that even if it was unspoken, there was something between you. And instead, these women were reporting to us that they would, if they saw another student or a teacher in the bar, that they would go to whatever length to avoid that person. And I just found that so heartbreaking, because it was like, well, that was what it did. This law, it did many things, but it pitted queer women against each other. And that's kind of what the whole film's about, because that was what I found to be most tragic in terms of the kind of legacy of the law. And so I want that scene, it was about trying to kind of capture the feeling for Lois whilst staying in Jean's perspective, but trying to capture that feeling of nervous excitement that's going on for Lois whilst at the same time addressing how that changes this space forever for the central character. So I don't know if I answered your question, but it was kind of trying to do quite a few different things at once that moment.
And you did.
It did. Well, I want to end with a very final, it can be a quick fire, just to kind of come back to bringing people together in every way, which your films have for you, for so many people who have watched them. I have to say, on a personal note as well, I realized rewatching Morven Kala that my best friend's first dance at their wedding was dedicated to The Ones I Love by the Mamas and the Papas. And I realized that it was because of Morven Kala. So coming back to the start of our conversation, the final question that we would like to ask you before wrapping up is, could you tell us any needle drop which you are planning or definitely having at your wedding? It doesn't have to be the first one. It can just be a one.
Oh my God.
No.
Oh my God. You know what? I haven't even thought about it. I feel so caught off guard. I'd say probably David Bowie, Ashes to Ashes.
That's it. That's the answer. In the same way that I message Gemma and say, this is the film about Blue Jean. That is the song. That's it.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to The Letterboxd Show. Our guest today was Georgia Oakley. Her stunning debut feature is Blue Jean, and it's in cinemas in New York and LA and additional cities this month via Magnolia Pictures. It's a Pride Month must-watch, but it's a must-watch any month, and we're always proud to be watching and talking about Blue Jean.
So true. Every month of the year. I watched it in February. That was the perfect month to watch.
I watched it last October, and it was perfect. We're all winners here. Thank you to our crew, editorial producer Brian Formo, our booker Sophie Shin, Sam for the art, Monica for the theme music, and Slim for all of the fancy edits. Slim, this week in particular, I'm so sorry that you just had to listen to so many non-American accents. Does it make you feel better if I just say something Paddington is nice and he's from
Coffee.
I'll sort you out. We're talking here.
We're talking here. There we go. Please, it's so American, Slim. You're going to love it. Please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts about our perfect non-American accents. It does help keep the show going. You can always drop us a line at podcast@letterboxd.com. We love mail. Let us know how you are today. I don't know. Keep your reviews and lists coming on Letterboxd, because we love sharing them with filmmakers on the show. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.